Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. This week on Meat and Three, we explore the relationship between food and style.
I knew from the start that I never wanted to, like, hot glue bread onto my body. Like, I wanted to be able to enjoy it after, and I did.
Food, which is so ephemeral, right, is something that you eat and it disappears. With an image, it remains. It stays alive forever.
Food and fashion align in that they're both lenses through which to look at culture, right? And they're both also tangible things we can use to express ourselves and our identities.
Tune in to Meat in Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And as I sit down to record this show, we are just approaching the nation's big holiday, the 4th of July weekend. And for some reason, my guest today in his new book just brought to mind thoughts of the 4th of July weekend, Independence Day, Americana. Well, the book is called Food Americana. And what do we think of the 4th of July? I mean, everyone's going to have a cookout, right? We're going to have hamburgers, hot dogs, barbecue, ice cream, some ice cream festivities. And then these are, of course, American foods, right? Did you ever stop to think what kind of foods they really started out to be? Well, you know, often I've done a lot of shows on American cuisine. Is it American cuisine? Do we have an American cuisine? All the different authors and historians who have written books saying, well, yes, we do, and here it is. And if you ask the regular viewer, well, what do you think of as American food? And what do they say? Hamburgers, hot dogs, pizza. Yeah, well, they're not wrong. But again, do they know where those foods came from? My guest today is author David Page, author, producer, journalist David Page. And his new book is, as I mentioned, Food Americana. And it's the remarkable people and incredible stories behind America's favorite dishes. David was a two-time Emmy winner journalist, two-time Emmy winner, and that was for his production in Food, right? He was a journalist, traveled all over. We'll hear from him on that. But then he decided to pursue his passion and traveled all over the world and learned about all kinds of different foods. And he created a show that was, again, groundbreaking. And that is Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. And he produced it for the Food Network. I'm sure that you have heard about it, or it's become sort of a reference now to diners, drive-ins, and dives, actually. And he really did that for 11 seasons. And it was interesting because I think that took him on another level, a level that I often go to myself, and that's that deep dive to find out what's there in the background. Where did a lot of these foods come from? And how is it that they became part of the American cuisine? David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me. And by the way, I just sit here and listen to you talk about me. It's great.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love being on this end of it because I get to ask the questions and talk about the people you see. And you have the hard part. You have to answer everything.
I'll do my best.
Right. This book is, as I said, it just, for some reason, it screams, maybe because the cover is, you know, the colors of the flag and there's stars popping out and, you know, there's a picture of ice cream and I don't know, a beer or something, or maybe it's Coca-Cola, you know, but the foods we think of so much as being American, and they are in now our iconic American treats. But they didn't start out that way. So why don't you give me a little background about why you started this book, why you wrote this book, and then we'll digress into Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Well, look, every TV producer thinks he has a book in him. Writing for television is not like writing a book. You can't just sit down and start telling your story. It was a dark and stormy night, and then Oedipus killed his father. What you have to do when you're making television is use your words as invisibly as possible to take your viewers to moments of reality. And I mean real reality, not reality show reality. Yeah. And over the years, I wanted to write a book. It's a different kind of journalism, and I never got around to it. And finally, 2.5 years ago or so, I said to myself, if you don't do it now, you're not going to do it.
Right.
So I forced myself to sit down at the computer. I almost said typewriter. That's how old I am. To sit down at the computer and see if I could do it and to enjoy the freedom that you... I love television. I've made television for half a century, and it's a wonderful thing. But there is a freedom in being able to not be constrained by the visuals that appeal to me, especially in telling detailed and complicated stories about food. So I sat down, I gave it a shot, and I found out, A, it's a hell of a lot harder than I thought. B, it's a lot of fun, and I'm very pleased with what I came up with.
Huh, that's great. But your fascination with food, were you always fascinated with food, by food?
No, not at all. I grew up without great food. My mother, God love her, was a wonderful parent and apparently a very talented accountant, but she couldn't cook to save her life. Mm. So I grew up with nothing special. Mm-hmm. And in all candor, it wasn't until I moved overseas that I started to develop an interest in food as more than just fuel. I mean, I liked it. I liked to eat. I've never been thin. But it wasn't until I moved internationally that I began to explore various cuisines and the cultures that went with them. And that became an enjoyment that just grew. It was that focus on what is the food of this place that I carried with me years later when I ended up doing Diners.
Yeah, you know, I think that is a, not that this is a common story by any means, but I think that's a very common story for people who travel and go abroad or maybe have to live abroad for a while, that you know, you're trying to, as you said, you're trying to find out what is the food of this place. And food really carries culture. And, you know, that's where you first learn about people, their tastes. And of course, even if you taste something, I'm sure you found, that might be recognizable to you or not, you know, that it always tastes a little different. What makes it taste a little different? Where are we? Why, you know, why am I eating this? And I think that it spawned my interest in food and food history. But for many people, I think when they travel and taste, have all those new tastes, to foreign lands particularly, they then get more interested in food and what they eat. I think it works.
Right. Yeah, and I sometimes ruminate about people who won't taste other things. You know, I've talked to plenty of folks who just won't try this or that. And I always say to them, try it. Take one bite. You could hate it. Great. But, you know, you can say you tried it. And the food, especially internationally, but certainly in the United States as well, the food really is a gateway into history and culture. You have entire cuisines that are built, for example, upon poverty. And you look back at a certain region like southern Italy, where if all you had was wheat and some tomatoes, well, then you could invent pizza as the food of the poor. And if you were lucky enough to have a piece of lard or an anchovy, you could top it. But then when you came to the United States and found a vast abundanza of foods available even to the poor, then you could translate your history of poverty into meat-filled red sauces and bountiful dishes. So you're really looking back, it's almost archaeological when you start to analyze what you're eating in a particular place and why.
Absolutely. Well said. In fact, you know, it's interesting that that particular story that you related as an analogy to the beginnings of certain foods is that they often can travel to America and, as you say, were enriched by the bounty and then traveled back again to their country of origin. And you know, Americans changed how some of those dishes became popular in other countries.
Well, you know, you can now get a California roll in Japan. It is identified as an American item, but it's become, I think, relatively popular. When you get Pizza Hut pizza in the Middle East or in Asia, you're buying an American food in the eyes of the folks buying it. I have no reports of Pizza Hut trying to stake a beachhead out in Italy. That would be a rough one.
Yeah, I think so. But isn't that interesting that we really consider pizza an American food? You know, I think everyone understands that because of the name, it has an Italian origin. But yes, we made it American. Mm.
And we made it American in so many ways. I mean, there are at least, he said, catching his bad grammar, 30 different American styles of pizza that are identifiable. And many of them are a million miles away from something you would find in Italy. I mean, there's a cheese that's popular in St. Louis called Provel, which is a processed sort of Swiss-like cheese. And for some reason, it was popular in St. Louis. And when pizza got to St. Louis, well, St. Louis pizza is topped with Provel. We have taken the basic shell of pizza, even though it was never, when it came to the United States, it could not be as it was in Naples because, A, we used different ovens. Ours were coal-fired, theirs were wood-fired. And, B, the protein content of wheat in the United States differed from the protein content of wheat in southern Italy. Mm-hmm. So it was not possible to create pizza here at that time that was the same pizza the immigrants had eaten back home. So right off the bat, American pizza was different, but we embraced it and it moved throughout the country. Although, bizarrely enough, it was in its least Italian iteration that it became most popular initially, because it was the pizza chains that were born in Michigan and Kansas that in the 50s and 60s started producing this generic, bland, not that I have any opinion on it, I hate it, the generic, bland, sweetened sauce thing that they called pizza. It was, however, through that generic, bland, sweetened thing they called pizza, because the name Frisbee had already been taken, that America in many, many places first tasted pizza. Similarly, it was Taco Bell, which no one would claim is truly Mexican food, that opened the door to an interest in Mexican food throughout the country, to be followed by Mexican restaurants, perhaps owned by Mexican immigrants or descendants of Mexican Americans. So we take stuff and we reduce it often to a low common denominator, not always, and then we build it back up. I mean, in the pizza world, artisanal pizza is a happening thing,
right,
all over the country. In the world of Mexican-American food, there is an increasing interest in regional items like birria de res, a spicy stewed beef dish that's amazing. But yeah, at some point, whatever it is we integrate into our cuisine, when it becomes popular enough to be desired all across the country, it's American. It's not what it was.
And I mean, the country, I mean, it, when it comes here, people, they're good things that, that, you know, that people adopted and brought back to America, and or through immigrants who cooked it, and they embrace, and Americans embrace it. I mean, they're all great tasting things. However, they were bastardized, on the other hand, you know, is not always a great thing. But
yeah, but let's replace the word bastardized with modified.
Okay.
All food ways evolve. One of the most popular dishes in China right now is scrambled eggs and tomatoes. When someone complains that the Chinese food they're eating is not, quote, authentic, I don't think they're thinking of scrambled eggs and tomatoes. I think it's essential that we acknowledge that the American versions of other countries' cuisines are different. There's Mexican food, and then there's Mexican-American food, a perfectly valid cuisine of its own. There's Chinese food, and then there's Chinese-American food, a perfectly valid cuisine of its own. I think you can, you shouldn't necessarily devalue what is done to other countries' foods when they come here. However, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't also want to taste or enjoy or often eat the foods as they were or are now eaten in those countries. In writing this book, I was taken by two young Chinese immigrants to a mall in Flushing in Queens, New York, the same neighborhood I was born in when it was Jewish and Italian. Now it's almost entirely Asian. And this massive food hall, and this was before COVID, featured stand after stand after stand of cooks and chefs serving up food as it is eaten today in China, or as close as they could get given difficulties with some ingredients, because there are now enough Chinese immigrants in America that you can make a living selling food to them,
right?
Selling food to non-Chinese Americans.
That's right. That does make a huge difference, indeed.
It's an incredible difference. And look, that hasn't covered the whole country yet. There are pockets featuring it throughout the country. The majority are on the two coasts, in the LA area and the New York area. The food was astonishingly good. Mm-hmm. Much of it was items that many Americans, unfortunately, would probably not taste.
Right.
Like duck blood or artery, but they were incredible. And also as a teaching experience, you know, American cuisine doesn't make much of texture. All of the textures we eat are within a pretty narrow range. Mm-hmm. Other cuisines, such as the various cuisines of China, because there is no one cuisine of China. It's a massive country with multiple cuisines. But most Chinese cuisines consider texture to be as much of an element of a dish as flavor. And there is a deep interest in a variety of textures, including some that I suspect most Americans would not like. But it's a highly educational experience to taste some of those things and to reflect on the fact that in terms of dealing with food as the sensual, not sexual, but sensual experience that it can and should be, we're leaving out a whole lot of the palate in this country and what we're willing to try and not willing to try.
Right. No, I it's a great point. And I think immediately of some particular Chinese dishes, some Italian dishes, you know, eating parts of the animals that, you know, maybe are a little chewier than what we're used to. Or slimy in Japan. Yeah, in Japan.
Oh, slimy is a big one. I grew up as a New York Jew, even though I was mostly raised in New England, but the grandparents were all in New York. And I vaguely remember a dish called pacha, which I think was jellied feet. Couldn't be pork. We were Jewish. The grandparents kept kosher. But I just wouldn't go near that because it looked to me like some kind of slime. And in later years, you know, I ought to look it up and see what it tasted like. I also enjoyed brains until my grandmother told me what I was eating.
What you were eating, right. Yeah. that's very common. I think this whole thing about that we are, and that's why I like the connection we have this, you know, recording this week to America's birthday, because we are a nation founded on all these immigrants and all, you know, bring your, you know, your tired, your poor, your huddled masses and your food. You know?
Oh, yeah. No, don't leave your food behind. In fact, I think it was Gustavo Adiano. I think it was Gustavo, who is a noted writer and authority on Mexican food,
right,
who said to me, traditionally, America has loved Mexican food and hated Mexicans. and, you know, there is a fair amount of truth to that, and not to get political on a food history podcast, but we continue as a country to broaden our interest in foods from elsewhere at the same time that we have this raging political debate over whether we should let people in.
Right. Just got to think of your food, people. Think of your food. Where would we be? You know, there are so many interesting stories about the backgrounds of food, and not all are as identifiably foreign or ethnic. For instance, I mean, many of them are, I guess, probably, no, I can't even say that. I'm thinking about wings, chicken wings, and no, because that has a real heavy Asian base as well.
It's got an Asian base, although I think that its original incarnation in the United States was as an offshoot of fried chicken, and historians debate whether fried chicken came from Scottish immigrants or enslaved Africans who were brought here, and having read both sides of that debate, I courageously say it was probably both.
Yeah. And you, if you look deep into a lot of other cultures, you'll see it in many other cultures as well. But how it was popularized in the States, I think we've got just probably the two.
Well, it takes you back to the food of poverty. I mean, the Southern fried chicken story includes the tradition of, in Black churches, the preacher going to dinner, lunch each Sunday at a different parishioner's house, which resulted in what's called the preacher bird, which is the fried chicken that would be offered to the preacher when he came to visit. And the hierarchy of who got to eat what, it started with the preacher who took what he wanted, and then dad, and then mom. And by the time it got down the table, you had like wings and feet for the kids.
That's right. That's great. But you mentioned fried chicken, and in your book, you mentioned a little something about a fried chicken renaissance. And I, for one who never thought that it went out of fashion, but talk about this renaissance as you refer to it a bit.
Well, in terms of whole fried chicken of the traditional format, over the past few years, pre-pandemic, it was becoming a hip dish. I mean, Sunday nights, it was the featured dish at the Chateau Marmont, where all the celebrities hang out in California. It's my sense that it was being featured on upscale menus in a way that it had not been for a number of years. But what's interesting, the real renaissance has gone down market in that the fried chicken sandwich wars of 2019 and 2020 put fried pieces of chicken front and center, and created a frenzy, if you will, that hasn't completely stopped. You know, McDonald's recently came out with another version. Was it McDonald's? I think so. Of their fried chicken sandwich. And now Burger King has come out with something that they want you to pronounce as the Chick-King, which is not, in my view, great marketing. But anyway, you know, David Portalatin, one of the country's leading analysts of the food business, pointed out two things. One, Americans love new things as long as they've had some form of it before.
Before, right.
And number two, he explained chicken overtook beef in this country as the number one protein quite a while ago. And much of the impetus for that may be us deluding ourselves into thinking we're being more healthy, because in reality, most of the chicken we're eating is fried.
Mm-hmm. And then you add a little heat to it, and then the hot chicken became
Look, Nashville hot chicken is still having a moment. It's and I hate to say this because I quite rightly featured it heavily in the book. I find the older I get, the less I want to burn the roof of my mouth. Mm. So it wouldn't be at the top of my list.
Oh, but it's good. Yes.
An individual piece of it can be wonderful. And then you have to drink milk.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, with a lot of Asian food, too, just keep that, you know, or Indian food, just keep the yogurt or the milk handy and, you know, you're OK. Right?
Yeah. But it's interesting you mentioned the prevalence of yogurt in cultures that feature extremely spicy foods. Because when you do hit that level of, this might hurt, it is milk products, not water that can ease the burn.
That's right. And get that fat to coat the mouth and get rid of the other stuff.
Or interestingly enough, hops from hop intensive beers can do the same thing, I am told.
That's why it's so good to wash all that hot stuff down with a beer. Okay, now I understand. Well, there are a few other stories that I wanted to get into, and I intend to, after we take a short break. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with David Page about his new book, Food Americana. Well, I guess you don't really have to guess what it's about. It's about food Americana. Yeah. But what's good is that the remarkable people and incredible stories behind America's favorite dishes. I mean, more so than favorite dishes, you could have gone, this could have been a tome, you know, of 18 volumes. But I would say more they're the iconic foods, as you've mentioned in the book as well. More so than just their favorite foods, because these are foods that everybody knows and everybody probably has had or celebrates. You know, they really are. The list. How did you limit the list? Number one, that's what I want to know.
I found out after years as a network news journalist that one of the wonderful things about being an author is you can determine the universe. You're without being unobjective, your opinion can shape things. And I did a fair amount of research, but in the final analysis, it was my decision on what foods I thought made up the core of an American menu. I did not include hot dogs because, there's very little cooking involved in a hot dog. And hot dogs will be in my next book, but the interest factor in hot dogs is what you put on them. It's sauces and such. So I left them out. I left basic beef out because, we like steak. But most of everything that I chose seemed to me to be an interesting food way that had permeated the culture. That you could find anywhere that when someone said, what should I eat today? These options, with the exception of the caviar chapter, came to mind. And I left some things out because even though they're popular, I don't think they have yet cracked into being part of American cuisine. For example, Thai food.
Well, I was just going to say Thai food, and you mentioned Andy Ricker, and you know, it's you have to laugh when you go back and you travel, because there was a time when Thai food was so unusual, right? And now every small city across America has got at least one Thai restaurant.
Yeah, but it's not, in my view, and this is just my opinion, it's not at the top of anyone's thought process. And if you got a Thai restaurant in a small town, it's probably not patronized by the majority of the population. It's different than your ability these days to pick up sushi at the 7-Eleven. I think
hold that thought.
I think of Vietnamese food the same way. There are a few things on earth as good as a banh mi, but it just isn't part of that core menu. And it may get there, it may not.
Yeah.
You know, there are some foods people have been trying to get us as a country to adopt with no success. I think most notably of Peruvian food, which is fantastic. And there have been real efforts made by chefs and tastemakers to get America on that bandwagon. And there are plenty of terrific restaurants serving it, but it hasn't broken through. And I don't know that, now you're back to what people like. Any cuisine that features as one of its most popular, most representative foods, beef heart is probably not gonna
be high on the list.
Yeah. Right. Although anticuchos are fantastic.
Yeah. Well, or sheep's heart for that matter. Malaysians eat a lot of sheep's heart.
I did not know
strange.
That.
Yeah. Weird.
Well, it's a muscle. What is beef? Beef's a muscle.
Eat it all.
The meat, I had some pho the other day with pork heart. It was terrific.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another food that pops into my head, you mentioned sushi.
Yes.
Now, Americans think they've sort of taken this over and they love their sushi. Well, you said the California roll, and now California roll you can get, you know, in Japan. That's an odd one to include in the group, I think.
No, not at all.
Obviously,
she is self-interested, but one of the top executives at the largest company producing pre-prepared sushi in America explained it to me this way. When she and her friends would duck out of high school for a quick lunch, they had burgers. Today, her kids have sushi. Yeah. Sushi is such a widespread item in America now. It's available in grab-and-go form at I don't have the statistic on this, so I am speculating, virtually every supermarket in the United States. It's certainly been at every supermarket I've been in recently. It's a daily option. You want to go out for sushi? Let's get some sushi. People, even as American sushi rolls grow larger and more complicated and higher in calories, sushi still carries that imprimatur of being healthy. Which is one of the things that helped launch it as an American item in the first place. But I would argue vehemently that sushi is about as American as you can get today.
Bagels.
Yes.
I don't want to touch on everything you wrote about. I want the people to read the stories for themselves.
It's okay. I like talking about it.
There are some things that just call to me, and you're my friend Josh Tupper, you talk to. For the
book, you know Josh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But bagels, again, here's something that you could find in major cities that had a concentration of ethnic populations. But now bagels are, you said, every supermarket. Lenders, as you mentioned in the book, you know, frozen bagels. Wow. Bagels became a part of America's cuisine.
Well, first of all, the number one seller of bagels in America right now is Dunkin' Donuts.
And I noticed that you did not include, you didn't include many sweet items at all other than ice cream, but donuts, that's for your next book.
Donuts. You know, donuts, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I don't think donuts are on much of an upswing at this point.
You think they're passe?
Well, let me put it this way.
No, not in New York.
Well, okay, but New York's different. Everything's available in New York. Dunkin' Donuts, which has now changed its name simply to Dunkin', describes itself in all corporate-related filings as a beverage company, as a coffee company. It makes a vast percentage of its revenue from coffee. Donuts are not necessarily, you know, when's the last time? Okay, you live in New York, it's different, but.
Well, these are gourmet, these are artisanal donuts. These are you know, fancy gourmet donuts.
Right.
These aren't Dunkin' Donuts we're talking about here.
And that's a wonderful thing. But when you think about what you're going to eat on a given day in Lincoln, Nebraska, going and grabbing an artisanal donut probably is not at the top of your list.
Yeah, you're right.
I haven't done enough research, but my opinion, and look, I grew up in New England, and then I was an investigative reporter for many years. So I've had plenty of Dunkin' Donut with a cop at the location late at night. So no, and by the way, the Dunkin' Donut original, the one with the little handle, is a great, wonderful, delightful thing. But I don't see the donut shop anymore as a central element in American cuisine. I mean, it's fine, but you're more likely to pick up one of those little boxes of miniature donuts at the convenience store.
Little donuts.
Well, look, Entenmann's anything is wonderful.
Right. But they have quite a history too behind them, an international history. So that's something for you to research. We'll get into that after the show. We'll talk about
it. It's a deal. Okay. Well, I'm working on the next book, so
good.
You know.
All right. Along with some other sweets. I mean, you got a whole sweets book to do. That would be great.
Sweets are interesting because, and I say this having done only a little research, I have a sense that sweets are far more regionally defined than some other items. For example, I live on the Jersey Shore, where if you can't get a cannoli at the local bakery, it is legal to blow the place up. That's probably not the same in Cleveland. Yeah. And there are probably baked goods in Cleveland that I don't know about that I can't get here.
No, but Texas is invading the rest of the country, certainly New York, with kolache. So,
well, kolache is a great item. So, and also remember, Texas, if you're going to food market, which is so much of what drives the opening of new kinds of restaurants in various places, there is no better marketing tag than Texas. Texas has a mythical place in American history. And if it comes from Texas, it might be at least worth looking at.
Yeah. All right. How about something that comes strictly from America?
Okay. Something that comes strictly from America, but I still argue we only know it and eat it because it comes from another culture, is lobster.
That's where I was going. All right.
Yeah. When the explorers and then the settlers came over here, they got their first look at North American lobster and they kind of gagged. That was not something to eat. The situation changed when these upper middle class Brits realized they were not trained in farming and they needed help from the Native Americans to survive their first few winters. They were taught how to cook lobster. Or first they were taught you could eat lobster, and then they were taught how to cook lobster by Native Americans who, at least some of the time, would wrap the lobster in seaweed and put it on the coals. And if that sounds somewhat reminiscent of the clam bakes that mm-hmm. continue to this day in New England, it ought to. Lobster. In fact, Ruth Reichel said to me that in her view, lobster ought to take the place of the hot dog or the hamburger or the pizza slice as the quintessential American food.
Yeah. The only problem is that other than farmed lobster, of course, the price and the availability,
that raises the regional availability question.
Right.
More and more recently, and when I say recently, I mean decades, what used to be regional American food has become more and more available elsewhere. And hence the conundrum. Lobster rolls sold from a food truck in someplace far, far away from the main coast aren't bad. The processing of lobster meat in Maine is a pretty sophisticated item these days. So you can have a pretty good lobster roll elsewhere, or you can go to Maine and have lobster the way those of us who grew up in New England think it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say if you should have to travel to Maine to get a good lobster roll? We see the same thing in for example, barbecue. You right. used to have to go to Memphis to get Memphis ribs. You used to have to go to Texas to get Central Texas brisket. And I say central because brisket is not the form of barbecue throughout all of Texas. Anyway, nowadays, there are many barbecue restaurants that are mixing and matching styles from all over the country. If they do it well, great. Many of them don't. I miss the mystique and the romance of traveling someplace and looking forward to what only they can serve.
Mm-hmm.
I live on the Jersey Shore. I believe that our oysters here are better than the oysters in New Orleans, but I sure look forward to that New Orleans oyster po' boy when I go to New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know. It's I feel strongly both ways.
But you're right. There are just a few remaining foods, as you say, that have to be eaten on site in their locale. I mean, this is homogenization of American cuisine is – we've got to seek to stop it and bring out something new.
Well, it's also, as things get popular elsewhere, we do things to them. For example, grits. Mm-hmm. Grits have become more popular throughout the country. They're no longer just in the South. And I was talking to some folks from South Carolina the other day about the fact that I enjoy shrimp and grits. But I ended up fessing up to the fact that I use instant grits.
Mm.
And they kicked me all over the place. I can still feel the wounds. And then they sent me a couple of packages, literally cloth sacks, mm-hmm. of heritage grits from South Carolina.
Queechy boy?
I don't remember. They're downstairs. And I made grits the other day, and it was a whole different experience. It was stunning. It was remarkable. So, that's another element of the available. Well, look, that takes us right back to bagels.
Yeah.
Which only became national because Mr. Thompson invented the bagel making machine. And the Lender brothers leased the first one and started producing and freezing bagels that could be sent all over the country. And whether it was that particular machine or ancillary equipment that fed dough into it, it was necessary. The Thompson company denies it's their fault, but bagel dough was thinned. And for the taste of the rest of the country, the bagels were made sweeter. Hmm. And that's what America came to know as a bagel. Now, the good news is, on the other side of that, the artisanal bagel industry, people actually making bagels by hand the way they used to be made, is on a major upswing throughout the country. So, right. You know, I guess everything comes around.
Yeah, I guess it does. You know, it's interesting. All of these stories are interesting. And I have to tell my listeners, you really, if you want a fun read, because it is a fun read, it's an interesting read. And it is, and it's also a lot of good facts and a lot of good research went into this. And it's just so many wonderful stories in here. And at first I thought, oh, well, they just eat a few different foods here. It's not that much. Oh, but you know, you go into the stories and it gets your mind to thinking. And I love that. I will say that the foods that seem to be the iconic American foods that you've picked out in particular, for the most part, tends to be what we now consider fast food.
Well, it's been, but which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Right,
I mean,
they're
foods that we liked enough that somebody said, well, I can sell a lot of these in a short period of time. Look, you could make a strong argument that it was the fast food business that made the hamburger.
Right.
Because the first fast food hamburger chain was White Castle, and they saved the hamburger from the hell of public opinion. Upton Sinclair had written The Jungle about the abuses of the meatpacking industry, and all of a sudden hamburger was reviled. So White Castle took that on directly, created restaurants that looked like hospital operating rooms.
White
tile and stainless steel.
Right.
And they prepared the food directly in front of the customer to prove that they weren't pouring sheep urine into anything. And I don't know where I came up with sheep urine.
Sorry.
And that is what made the hamburger what it became. So I think you could argue that the chain was essential in addicting us to burgers, though they certainly existed long before the chains. But so much of the rest of it, I think we liked enough that somebody said, well, I could sell a lot more of this. And they did. And by the way, not always with terrible results. I mean, I haven't eaten KFC in quite a while, but back in the day, I recall KFC as being damn fine fried chicken. I don't know what they've done to its, you know, they have 3,000 different versions now, so who knows. Right. But at one time, that was good. The dirty little secret many professional chefs won't share is that they love Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
It's long been a cult favorite among people who make food for a living. So chain food doesn't have to be terrible. And it often gets an unfair rap. Although what's interesting is now you see hamburger chains like Five Guys or Smashburger doing, in essence, what White Castle did by saying implicitly to people, you don't want to eat that garbage at McDonald's. We make a good burger. And the so-called better burger niche is doing very well.
Yep. You know, and pizza, back to pizza again, and hot dogs and pizza, hot dogs, hamburgers, I guess that all kind of in one lump sum. But you had mentioned how Ruth Reichel said lobster should replace
the rest of the pantheon. Yes.
Right. I read somewhere, or I was talking with some people somewhere, that, you know, it used to be, you have to go out, you got to go on a run, and kids need dinner and inexpensive, and you give them a hot dog, right? Hot dog, a lot of, how many kids grew up on hot dogs?
Right.
And it's no longer hot dogs, but it's pizza. Pizza is the number one go-to meal for many families. I mean, that's just,
Well, pizza. First of all, they'll bring it to your house.
That would be better, right?
Secondly, it has a number of comfort food attributes. It's warm. It's tactile. Depending upon what you put on top of it, it can be gooey. And it makes kids happy.
Right. And, you know, it's actually, I'd rather see them eat that than a lot of other things. I mean, it does have healthy aspects to it. I mean, you know,
pizza by definition is not bad for you.
No, now, not at all.
A pizza with a stuffed crust and 42 pounds of sausage may not be in your best interest. But, and you know, the thing is, pizza is one of those things that is usually okay. We have a takeout pizza joint on this island that we will sometimes, because neither one of us wants to cook or get up off the couch, we will sometimes order from. It's perfectly adequate pizza. I know what I'm getting. Nothing about it is going to make me jump up and down and bring out a new edition of my book. But it's fine.
Fills you up, and you didn't have to make it.
Yeah, it's fine. And by the way, I learned writing the book how hard it is to make pizza. I went to pizza school in San Francisco. And I got to tell you, this is far more complicated than anybody realizes if you're going to do it right.
That's right. Well, with that, I think you are very interesting. The book is very interesting. We could go on talking about every food we've eaten, and because it's all good on some level, right?
Of course.
And I look forward to what comes next from your search and deep dive into foods. Doesn't have to be food Americana next time. It can be, hey, let's, you know,
it's not the next one, but I would love, because I particularly love it, I'd love to do the food of the Mediterranean. I got to put that on the get-to list.
All right, put that on your list. Okay. Sounds good to me. All right. David Page, it's been a pleasure, truly a pleasure. And the book, again, is Food Americana. And David is also the creator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, which we really didn't get to talk about, but how Americana is that, right?
So, absolutely.
Right. So stay tuned. Maybe we'll hear something more from David in the near future. Thanks,
Linda,
David.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. And I want to let you know that A Taste of the Past has been engineered by HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And they have kept us on the air for over 11 years now. So if not, they haven't, but you have, because it's a listener supported network, radio network. And if you can just go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart in the upper right corner, or just go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and show us a little love, because you are what keeps us on the airwaves. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. and I hope you saved a little room for dessert.